One of the tactics we've seen governments use to suppress speech throughout this series is revoking nonprofit status or otherwise making it difficult for organizers to get funding to stay afloat. That happens in other ways too. I wanted to talk to Céline Semon this week about exactly this problem. Céline runs a project called Slow Factory. They do educational initiatives on social media and via online learning platforms and events, connecting the dots for people on art, science, history, and colonization. Their content is really interesting. Céline's a designer, so it's always very beautiful to look at. And they do a really great job of making really complicated issues accessible. Over the past few months, Slow Factory has been outspoken in calling for a ceasefire in Gaza, and as a result, has lost all of its funding in a matter of just a few months. We're going to hear from Céline on that and why it's more important than ever for the climate movement to be a justice movement. That conversation is coming up after this quick break. You're listening to Drilled, and I'm Amy Westervelt.
This holiday season, get a gift for yourself, too, and keep it simple. I gave myself the gift of a better, more convenient laundry experience. I know, laundry doesn't sound like a gift, but honestly, EarthBreeze just makes it so much easier. Think about how you actually do laundry. You have to work out how much detergent to pour, lift that big plastic jug, hope the goo doesn't get everywhere. It's annoying. But EarthBreeze Eco Sheets look like nothing I've ever seen in the detergent aisle. It's like a dryer sheet kind of, but it's the detergent and you throw it in and then that's it. There's no measuring, no nothing. It works in hot and cold. It's also dermatologist tested, hypoallergenic, and free of bleach and dyes. And it fights everyday stains and odors. You get a powerful clean, but you don't have to deal with all that packaging. Right now, my listeners can get started with EarthBreeze and save 40%, 40%. Go to earthbreeze.com/drilled. That's earthbreeze.com/drilled for 40% off your subscription. earthbreeze.com/drilled.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
I'm Céline Semon. I'm one of the co-founders of Slow Factory. Slow Factory is a non-for-profit for now working at the intersection of climate justice and human rights. Particularly, we've been studying for the past decade, looking at the impact of climate on human health and also the impact on climate on geopolitics and human rights in general. And so I've started working on Slow Factory in 2008, just as a research, trying to connect the dots between a lot of things that were impacting my lived experience, but also were part of my area of work and area of expertise. At the time, I was working on digital access to information, digital literacy, access to the internet, essentially training folks to be on the internet, working with groups, human rights groups, to try to get the internet in Lebanon, get people connected, get people online. And with that work, a lot of things were interconnected. And a lot of things were becoming much more part of a global system for me. And I was starting to understand that we exist within many systems, compounding systems, and every single system is impacting another. But when we were advocating or creating stories or trying to communicate certain issues to the general public, we realized that folks were not used to seeing systems or understanding systems, that in fact, if the world was pretty decent for them, they weren't even aware there were systems out there that may or may not be working in it for the advantage of the majority. And so I started Slow Factory trying to connect the dots between different things that were interesting to me: access to information, digital literacy, human rights, climate justice, geopolitics, and a little bit of fashion, a little bit of culture, a little bit of storytelling. And what does that create? What could we create with all of this?
I didn't know you started in 2008. That's amazing.
But it launched in 2012. So from 2008 to 2012, I was researching. I was trying to figure out a way to make it work, because a lot of people back then told me I need to pick one thing. And, you know, often the advice was do one thing and one thing well. It was like the boom of startup culture. Every single startup is like one service, you know, and I really, really was convinced that we need to do many things at the same time and doing them all well.
And you were always looking at climate intersecting with all these things, right? That's not like a new thing. You were always looking at all these things together.
Yes, of course. I mean, for me, climate is a new word. At the time, we were talking about environmentalism or the environment. And I remember, like, you know, in 2008, for example, very few people used the word climate next to justice. It was more like climate change. And the narrative were about environmentalism. And to be an environmentalist, you would have to be part of a certain category of people. And it wasn't really given that someone coming from Lebanon, you know, who doesn't really have a science degree, would be interested in climate and would be able to impact climate spaces.
Totally. I'm super interested then to hear your thoughts on just how much it's changed from 2012 to now. Like, I feel like there's been maybe a couple of cycles where the broader climate movement has gotten a little bit better about seeing these intersections. And then I don't know if you've seen this too, but I feel like I've seen people really like backpedaling on that in a very troubling way in the last year or so. So yeah, I'm curious just what you've seen on that front and what you think the blockers are to people understanding that these things really are all interconnected.
Climate for me and the stories around climate are all about culture. And there's something that, you know, we keep saying in this space, which is like, if you want policy change, you have to really be able to impact culture, because policy follows culture. And the other thing also that I've observed is that, you know, in 2011, 2010, climate wasn't really part of the everyday media conversation. You know, I think it really entered the mainstream in a massive way around 2019 and really made its way clearly in 2020, where everyone was like, oh my God, you know, like when everyone was home during COVID, if they were lucky enough to be healthy at home, they, you know, most of the people were online just consuming digital information and being like, oh my goodness, I need to change, or I need to make a change in my life, which we'll talk about that because that's in its way problematic. But going back to what you were asking, you know, I feel like part of telling people the stories around climate and telling people about systems and systemic change or systemic oppression is really about, you know, broadening their perspective, because, you know, encountering, like realizing that there's a system in place, oftentimes systems are designed to be invisible and they're designed to be, you know, omnipresent, invisible. You don't really pay attention to them. If they work in your favor, you don't have a perceived notion that a system is in place. It's only when the system doesn't work in your favor. For example, when you find yourself on the phone with customer service mm-hmm. right? And saying, this doesn't work. And the customer service is a robot. And it's like, press one to speak with a representative. And you're mm-hmm. like, oh my God, this doesn't work. Like, what's happening? That's when you realize that the system is there and the system might very well be not in your favor. Mm-hmm. For people of the global majority, we are born and raised in a broken system. We're realizing that the system is not in our favor and we learn to navigate around it. We have an additional systems literacy in place in our cultures because that's how our lived experience has, you know, created our perception of life. When we have to explain that to people, and I often consider myself a translator, you know, translating cultures. And as a designer, a lot of our work as designers are about translating complex yeah. systems, translating the database to becoming an interface so that people can relate to it, translating really complex data back to people so that they can relate to them. So I really, really see myself as a translator in translating our lived experience, our cultures from the perspective of the global majority, from a very well lived experience in the global South to folks in the global North who don't understand often that A, there's a system in place that is not in the favor of the majority. B, that they are participating in that system. And C, that that system is in fact crumbling and, you know, it's not sustainable. That system is not sustainable in itself because it's not designed in a way that is in alignment with the larger system, the ecosystem that we live in, you know? And so being able to explain these things in a way that is relatable, that is not riddled with shame and guilt and anger, which is a big work that we have to do behind the scenes at Slow Factory, which is about, you know, transmuting these emotions, you know, alchemizing these emotions so that our message is as clear as possible mm-hmm. to the general public that has the power to create change in any which way that they can.
Yeah, I think at least, you know, once a month, I'm really struck by how well you guys translate a very complicated issue into a very accessible story. It's not easy. You do it really well. So a thing that I get asked a lot is like, well, so you're raising awareness about this or that thing, but what impact does that really have? And I'm curious, like it's an annoying statement, but I'm curious how you, yeah, it's very annoying. Like,
can you measure this impact, you know?
Yeah. Well, and also actually for funders too, right? Like they're constantly yes. asking for those kind of metrics. And I was just talking to someone the other day where I'm like, you know, none of the metrics that we have actually capture how impact works. Like I was telling someone the other day about something that totally shifted my thinking on something. And it was just like one conversation with one person. But I'm like, but you know, probably like five other conversations I had leading up to that one, like started me down that path. And how do you measure that? You know? So anyway, yeah, I'm curious just how you think about that whole, you know, impact thing.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. We are working now on an impact report. We never used to work on these before. We were just very grassroots, very much moving from a place of, I would say, passion and compassion. And it's only in 2020 that we started to compile the data. Because we were observing change. It was very palpable that what we were creating was impactful, but we didn't measure it prior to 2020. And so we mm-hmm. retroactively measured using two different techniques. Again, my background is in tech. Mm-hmm. So, okay, my background is in data mm-hmm. and measuring data and understanding data and understanding that data on its own means nothing without information and without storytelling and wisdom. So data, the number on its own, needs to be contextualized. So for us, we do use, you know, a methodology that incorporates hard data, the reach, mm-hmm. just the numbers. The numbers themselves are enormous. The reach of Slow Factory daily is about 10 million. which is insane because like we're just a social media platform. Mm-hmm. We're working on growing into various other things. That's why we're fundraising. But on our own, just as a lo-fi, I would say, storytelling method, like output, mm-hmm. daily, it's you know, enormous. So data, just calculating data, observing yeah. data, looking at AdWords that are being out there, and just also looking at Google words, what are the words that are the most searched after we launched a post, and correlating this research. Mm-hmm. That's a way to measure. And then the other way is through empirical data. So testimonies, people that are emailing us, people that are participating in our surveys, comments, like what people are commenting about and how they are, you know, susceptible potentially of changing their perception. And that data is harder to pinpoint. So it takes longer to research and to map. But the two together are really indicative that what we're creating is effective on narrative change, and it's effective on debunking a lot of misinformation. And it's done in a way that's so accessible that it's shared widely, and it becomes sort of a starting point for people to research further, which we also offer with our program on open education. It's about 200 free classes under the framework of OpenEDU that we've developed, which is about climate justice, human rights, cultural change. And under this wheel of information, I would say, we offer classes to go deeper into the entry points that we offer on social media. So there's a funnel of, you know, engagement from mm-hmm. the 10 millions that are engaging on social media, hundreds of thousands are continuing their experience through OpenEDU, which is, I think it's not everything, but it's like a very good pathway that we could mm-hmm. continue investing in.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Okay. Can I ask you a little bit about the book that you're working on? It sounds so interesting.
Yes. You can.
When I saw the description, I was like, oh man, that'd be so much fun to research. I bet you're like way down the research rabbit hole.
Yes, I am. Wow, what can I say? Well, first, the book is almost, it's done. I am ready to launch it.
Oh, amazing.
Yes. It's called A Woman is a School. Mm-hmm. And it's stories as data points for collective liberation. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot of stories from the Global South, from women, some men, some, you know, of my personal stories, lived experiences that span between, I would say, 1948, which is a very important date in the region, and today. And it's basically a documentation of lived experiences from that time in Lebanon. What it tells us also, this A Woman is a School is...
The title.
Thank you. Because when you are teaching a woman, you are really teaching her entire community. And it's very much about the what I've learned outside of school, like how I was brought up. It's a documentation of what I believe is an endangered culture, the culture of the Global South, which is an important culture when we look at our collective survival during a time of transition, during the time that we're in, which is a time of great transition. You know, we're talking about climate transitions. We're talking about economic transition. We're talking about political transitions. We're in a time of deep turmoil. And for, you know, looking at how do we survive climate change? How do we survive climate change? It's always a question I hear people ask. It really depends on the culture that, you know, your community has. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is that in the Global North, for example, I feel like the book is a lot about an anthropological study, you know, at least a very, you know, as a cultural anthropologist myself, it's mm-hmm. a cultural and anthropological observation and documentation of what collective collectivism and collective cultures are mm-hmm. about. Mm-hmm. And how I was raised in radical generosity, how I was raised in, you know, my understanding of the origin stories of our world that are mm-hmm. different from origin stories that are, you know, for instance, Judeo-Christian or that are, you know, told in the global north. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it's a documentation of our endangered culture.
I'm super excited to read it. When does it come out?
So I'm in the process of separating with my publisher mm-hmm. and starting an imprint under Slow Factory to publish the book in September. Mm-hmm.
That's amazing.
So, I mean, this is really news because the emails are still hot. So
oh, that sounds a little bit stressful. I hope it all goes well.
I'm not stressed anymore about this because the system never really worked in my favor since I was a child. Mm-hmm. And I've kind of lost the disillusionment that the system will one day be in my favor or embracing of me and my culture and working for my greatest good. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. and so I am ready. I've always been ready. I've done everything on my own.
Yeah. You know,
for instance, I'm a designer, but like I have been rejected from every single design school I applied to. Mm-hmm. And the design work that we do at Slow Factory is one of the most effective design work I've seen out there. And I just feel like, fuck the schools and the universities and whatever and the system that can't embrace the wisdom that comes from the global south, because then we're going to just do it on our own, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry. It's true. That's wild to me. Cause yeah, your stuff is amazing. And like, yeah.
And I never dare to call myself a designer. I even like when I say it, I really have to work on myself because I never even credit myself in any of the designs that I do. But like I do the majority of these designs with my team. I personally design the posts. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, and so, and I work through a methodology that I've created and I train my team to understanding what I understand of design, you know, mm-hmm. and I don't know, I feel like this whole idea of being a designer is so exclusive mm-hmm. that I decided to be a designer of the world.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, it's your stuff is excellent. And I feel like I definitely see more than one, you know, account cribbing off of it. So, thank
you. I think that we have defined a visual language that folks think is just up for grabs.
Yeah.
We had to change our fonts several times. We had to also go and reach out to some people that were in the direct line of work and say, honey, like this is literally our design language. Mm-hmm. Why not build upon it? Why
not exactly build something new?
At least mm-hmm. improve it, like build mm-hmm. upon our work and credit the work, which is something I feel Generation Z is not used to. Everything mm-hmm. is like, I discovered this on TikTok or I discovered this on Instagram. Therefore it must be free. Mm-hmm. Where back in 2001, when we started with the internet, the work was very defined as you have to trace back the source because then you are building a stronger web. When you break mm-hmm. the web, you literally break the movement.
Yeah.
And I don't understand, why would you break the movement? Like, why would you not say, this is from this and this is from that and this is where I got it from? Then you're
building, not just like, yeah. It's true. I was talking to someone who works in academia the other day academia is far from perfect on this front and there are plenty of problems with it. But one thing that they mentioned was that everyone, you know, when they're doing research, it's just sort of like, yeah, of course it's building on what came before and I'm going to cite what came before because that's how we build an understanding of something. Mm-hmm. I wish that all these other realms had just accepted that as well. So, okay, I want to talk about Billboard's First Ceasefire, which you just launched, right? Last week? Was it last week in LA?
In LA, correct. Yes. We tried to do it in New York first, but
what happened?
We got censored.
No.
Yeah, we made a little video about it that went semi-viral. That's how we actually got the contact from LA. Someone was like, hey, I saw you guys are trying to put billboards up in New York. And because we put the video, like we created a short documentary just to show how hard it's been to just have these messages out.
Yeah.
And someone reached out to us and said, oh, I saw you guys trying to put out billboards in New York. I run a billboard organization. Can I help you? Like, I work specifically with nonprofits.
Amazing.
Yeah. And we were like, oh my gosh, yes, yes. We couldn't put the word, you know, genocide up there, but we managed to put pretty much everything we wanted, calling for ceasefire. You know, we call our billboards Skittles for Palestinian justice because we purposefully chose Skittle colors. So that people don't stop at the red, green, and black colors that represent Palestine.
Yeah.
And that their guards are down when they're looking at these Skittle colors.
Yeah.
And so they could read the message and understand that, you know, what we're asking for is as cute as Skittles.
And they went up just last week, right?
Yes, they went up last week. They're going to be there for a month.
That's
They're
amazing.
In 10 locations in Los Angeles, which is, I think, the heart and soul of storytelling, especially for mainstream.
Yeah.
All of the stories that are mostly in our disadvantage come from there and are designed there, and they are filmed there. You know, every single representation of Arab lives, whether it's on the TV or on the big screen, is, you know, produced in LA. So, you know, this was our way to planting some seeds, some watermelon seeds.
Yeah.
The belly of the beast.
That's really interesting. I wanted to ask you too about how the climate movement has been, I would say, very visibly absent from any of the discussion on Gaza. I feel like it's maybe starting to turn a little bit. Like, I think Rafa was a little bit of a turning point where more people started to speak out. But yeah, I'm curious just what you've seen on that front. And I'd like to ask you to kind of explain for folks who might be listening, who might have this mindset of like, well, what does this have to do with climate? You know, maybe have you answer that question from your perspective.
I'm going to try to do this without sounding so bitter. I realize that
it's hard.
Me saying Generation Z with all my bitterness. First of all, I am raising a teenager who is from the Generation Z, and I'm raising my children, also Generation Alpha, in a way where I'm trying my best to represent, you know, this lineage of culture I was part of. So definitely, if you're out there listening and you're part of that group, do remember that you need to state your sources, because you create a stronger web in that way. And then your movement is unbreakable. And don't break the movement that you were born into. Remember that you were born into an existing movement. And the relationship with boomers are great, but they are at the disadvantage of the folks that have been fighting against and building the platforms that, you know, a lot of you are dancing on and, you know, shooting your TikToks on and, you know, doing brand partnerships on in the name of climate justice. I just have to say, I'm saying this with love, and as a mom, just careful with how you are doing a disservice or how you're building upon someone's work, how you are able to build upon each other's work. So I'm prefacing that for the talk about Palestine, because the work that we're doing in the region and in Lebanon, Syria, Yemen, and Palestine, of course, has been a litmus test in the movement for climate justice, not just now, but forever. You know, and we have lost a lot of relationships and opportunities because of where we are and how we advocate for human rights. And you're correct. Like, yes, the climate justice movement has been harmfully silent about Palestinian rights. And if they have spoken, it was when it was safe for them to do so. And they have spoken in ways that was erasing Palestinian voices that came before them, Arab voices that came before them, purposefully hurting Arab-led groups like Slow Factory in multiple ways, you know, prior to this moment. So it's a shame that we are all talking about climate justice, which is a movement that exists within collective liberation, and that we have a hard time being in solidarity with Palestinians in a way that is selfless, that is not done in a way that is just good for you right now in an individualistic framework, which is a lot of the things I talk about in my book, that if we want to see collective liberation, we really, really have to understand that there are other ways to exist besides the individualistic approach, the capitalistic approach. And it's true that groups have been not only silent, they've been actively silencing Slow Factory and defunding Slow Factory. And the climate justice groups that are purposefully silent are benefiting financially from funders that are Zionist funders that are working, you know, around the clock to defund the work that we're doing. We have lost every single funder since October.
Wow.
Every single foundation, brands, everyone.
Wow.
Defunding our work. And I'm being honest and vulnerable because I don't understand anymore how else should I be, you know, what should I play? What kind of game do you want me to play to be like giving you, you know, the reality of behind the scenes. So you, everyone understands that Slow Factory is really working out of a miracle since it was created, because no one really understood what Slow Factory was. And still, most of the time people say, I love Slow Factory. I just don't know what you all do. What do you mean? We work at the intersection of climate justice and human rights through education, design, and science. What's so complicated about that? Yeah, but like how? What's your business model? We don't have a business model.
Yeah.
You know, we are a public service.
Yeah.
And we're creating massive impact because we are so raw.
Yes. Totally. Also, I feel like all of your work on Palestine has been really, really well researched, really thoughtful. That's awful and stressful.
It's very stressful.
Very, very stressful.
And it's stressful because not because we are not good at what we do.
No.
It's not because we are not effective. It's not because we have not measured our impact. It's not because we are not creating massive impact. No, it's because we are creating massive impact.
Yeah, that's
It's because we are so effective. Mm-hmm. It's because we are perceived as potentially a threat. What are they talking about? Systems change. I don't want my system to change. Can we just do it in a way that just doesn't change anything? No, we can't. And whether you like it or not, it is changing. It's not me personally, Celine Saman, who is like a lady from a fucking refugee from Lebanon, who's changing your fucking system. Sorry to be so blunt. It's changing. So why not work with it? Why not embrace it with creativity? Why not work with people who understand it, who know how to impact it, who know how to design around it, who understand it on a visceral level. Like, work with us. Join us. You know? I don't know. I feel like at this time, I'm just letting go and just opening up to whatever is going to occur.
I find it so mind-blowing that there are still people out there that are like, I don't know. Yeah, I guess just trying to resist any kind of systems change by trying to keep climate focused on specific technological solutions or one particular politician or things like that. It's draining to watch it over and over again. How do you keep going in the face of all that?
I don't know how I keep going. The best way I can explain is like when I was giving birth to my first child, every pain felt like that's it. It's the end of the world. I'm going to die. I can't take it anymore. I can't take it anymore. And then I would get into another level, another threshold of pain. And then again, I would say, I can't take it anymore. That's it. I'm dying. And then another threshold of pain would take me to another layer and layer of pain. And I would open up and open up and open up and be able to handle this pain and eventually, you know, go through it. That's how I feel right now with everything that I'm witnessing coming out of Gaza in English, and coming out of Lebanon. You know, they're bombing Lebanon. They're bombing Lebanon everywhere. They're bombing Syria. You know, they want us silenced and erased. And I really believe it's because we hold, you know, a lot of wisdom. We hold a lot of wisdom. Like, our cultures have survived so much. And because of that, we know, we have in our, you know, DNA so much resourcefulness and resilience and creativity and wit. And, you know, all of that is needed in today's day and age of great transformation. I hope my message doesn't scare folks that have the means to support this work. I hope, and my work has always been in being as open and welcoming as possible so that we can create an international change.
I know I'm only a data point of one, but it's always very accessible, welcoming, never like lecturing or anything like that. You know, it's just like informational, which is hard to pull off too. So, and to your point before, the systems are changing, and you know, you can either resist that and fight it, or you can try to join other people that are like working to design a better system. I guess I don't understand the resistance to it.
I also don't, and I try to not judge it anymore. I try to to just release it. I feel like, for instance, in the imprint, for the Slow Factory imprints, Books for Collective Liberation, yes, my book is one of them, but it's one book amongst hundreds of books that we're going to publish that are from our fellows that we fund, that are from our instructors that we fund. I mean, there are other people out there. You know, we're really a big web of people working towards these ideas of systems change, of collective liberation, of cultural change, of, you know, climate justice. And those books don't exist in the traditional publishing world.
Yeah.
I mean, if they do exist, they have to follow a certain regimen that I believe takes away sometimes in what the story is about. And so that's one of the ways in which, like, how do I keep going? To me, I feel like as long as I have life in my body, which is not a given, you know, it's not a given. I don't take it lightly. I myself am a survivor of war. So every day I think of death. Every day I think that's it. If today is my last day, that's what I want to do today. Every single day, that's how I live. And even for Slow Factory, if it must die, it will die a wonderful death.
Yeah.
And it will be going out beautifully.
Yeah.
And every time, like, Slow Factory has existed in that scarcity or in that, you know, miracle, because we can also look at it as that, where many times I've been here where I was like, oh my goodness, that's it. That's it.
Yeah.
And then it's not it.
Mm-hmm.
Never is, because I feel like for me, it's also a personal journey towards growth, towards power. Yeah. You know, when you are part of the global majority, maybe I'm generalizing, but when you come from nowhere and nothing, really, it's hard to embrace all of the things. And that is also my personal journey in expanding, you know? And I'm mirroring that with Slow Factory, and it's mirroring that in me. And like, I know their spiral is just upward, and our, you know, work is just starting, because we just wrote a TV show, for example, internally at Slow Factory, and we're working on fundraising for that. It's called Connecting the Dots, and it's about connecting the dots, like I did when I started Slow Factory. You know? I'm literally spilling all the beans to you, Amy. Like, everything I'm saying has got this, Like, no one knows this, like, besides our team. So I don't know if it's good or bad. I don't know. I feel like at this time, I'm just feeling like I just can't be real. There's no way to be. Like, what do you want me to be? Like, I really feel like we're, like, the clock is ticking, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. There's no more time for, like, bullshit.
Yeah. I mean, I've never been very versed in bullshitting. I've never knew how to do it. I was always, like, somewhat unable to, sadly, for my own, you know, basically disadvantage, because it never served me to be raw and real. But I really don't know how else to be. Like, we are working behind the scenes with everything we've got.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And everyone in my team is as raw and as vulnerable and as passionate and as compassionate, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
As I am.
Well, I'm very glad you're out there doing your work. It's inspiring. I think it's so necessary for people to just be able to see people working the way that you work and presenting this other vision of the future. Because it's hard for people to see without that. And I think you bring real value to the world. So I appreciate it. Again, data point of one, but I know I'm not alone.
I love that. I love data point of one. Well, people say if you are able to change one person or to affect one person, your impact is already a lot. And so I feel like everyone who's working on impact work, you know, don't be intimidated by measuring it. You know,
like,
it doesn't matter really if it's one or millions, because one person can tell another person. And we're a culture of word of mouth, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Honestly. And like, I find, at least my own experience, I am most influenced by like one-on-one conversations.
Mm-hmm. You know? So like, yes.
Yeah.
We're trying to bring those back more, because we do create like large scale, you know, information. And when we, before COVID, we used to run one of the largest climate and culture conference study hall. And cool. It was like thousands of people. And, you know, it was never like so intimate. And since COVID, we kind of said, all right, let's reshift everything. And now we've been doing a lot more intimate things.
That's
cool. You know, like smaller group. In LA, for example, we had a workshop on Friday, February 23rd called Collective Healing and Radical Imagination. What will you design when empires fall? And it was like a beautiful, intimate gathering.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, awesome. Patrice Cullors, who is one of the founders of Black Lives Matter, did a meditation called the Abolitionist's Meditation, which is part of her new offering and work right now. It was so beautiful to be able to be in community and to be able to let go and put our guards down, put our weapons down, put our, you know, even if your weapon is a pencil, which is what our weapon is, put it down, your microphone down, you know, everything, and just be in community. A lot of people cried. We joke around at Slow Factory that we need our next t-shirts should say, I cried at Slow Factory, because we cry a lot. We cry a lot. But then I was like, maybe people will perceive this as like we're torturing you at Slow Factory.
I love it. Where should people find you? Like, what are the things that you want to point people towards?
Would love to point people to the OpenEDU platform. We are launching OpenEDU again in March, which is in a few days, with a lot of amazing classes that are at the intersection of geopolitics and climate. I think that are necessary for all people interested in climate justice to understand that geopolitics are very much intertwined with our climate movements and what are their impacts. Also, indigenous cultures and climate justice, pan-indigenous cultures around the globe, not just for Turtle Island, but including Turtle Island, of course. And, you know, just join us, OpenEDU. It's going to be really phenomenal. The theme for March is systems literacy. So really helping everyone understanding systems, perceiving systems, designing systems.
Yeah,
and I'm going to be teaching as well. So I'm very excited. So OpenEDU for sure, and sign up for our newsletter to just know when it's going to happen. And of course, Media Justice, if everyone wants to support our Media Justice work, it's not just the billboards, it's also what we are working around in social media and translating complex information. It's also going beyond the billboards into mainstream newspapers. So please join us and help us and, you know, bridge your impact with ours.